chair of the FFC is not here, but Dr. Brown is here, the CEO, which is for me a principal matter. So I put it to members, do we wait for Professor Blaikies, or do we ask the CEO to carry on doing the presentation? Because the business we are dealing with is serious business. It's a recommendation for the 2019-2020 Division of Revenue. I put it to members. Honorable Monakedi.
I'm not sure what is the arrangement that has been made between the CEO and the chairperson. If the chairperson does not have a problem in him proceeding with the presentation, I would then suggest that we need proceed, especially that I do know that the Honorable Mudla Shubing at some point.
No, I know. I'm well aware.
If we could start with the meeting.
Any other member? Or the Honorable de Blanche?
Chairperson, I also agree that we should be going on. I'm just concerned, how did the double booking, how welcome? I mean, you know, who made the bookings? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, members. Mindful of the time also, welcome to Honorable Zamandi. Dr. Brown, you are the CEO of the FFC. Maybe you can give some clarity, this double booking, and what is the arrangement between the chair and yourself? Just clarify for us that we proceed with the presentation.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Humblest apologies. I was under the impression that you were aware of the logistical arrangements. Essentially, the agreement between myself and the chairperson is that he would make his way back as soon as he's able. The meeting for health started at 9:30. I have also sent one of the staff over to go and see if they can physically extract him as soon as possible. But I have the mandate, should the committee agree, to continue and to carry on until he joins us.
Thank you for the clarity. Let's just do the formalities. Secretary.
Thank you, Chair President. Yes, Chair President, there's an apology from Ms. Motara. She's attending SADC meetings. Thank you, Chair.
Apology for Honorable Motara. That's at the SADC meeting. Can we adopt that? Accept that apology? I think it's, yes, we can accept it. Thank you very much. Honorable members, very important meeting. We are in an environment called a constrained fiscal environment in South Africa with sluggish growth. The objective, as also outlined by His Excellency the President Ramaphosa, as he said, there must be policy certainty, there must be higher growth, there must be development and transformation interventions, restore sound corporate governance and sound financial management, root out corruption, increase monitoring, evaluation, control over action plans and implementation, and reduce unemployment. Now, we've got the benefit to the FFC team and Treasury that we did a lot of oversight outside of Parliament at grassroots level to monitor implementation, to follow the money, what is actually happening in different provinces. And looking at your recommendations, it fits into that picture, our experience and what you actually are recommending. So with that short introduction, I'm going to hand over to Dr. Brown. Honorable members, you've got the research document, Yolanda. Thank you very much. excellent paper. Yes, Mr. Dlomo, eventually we've got the content advisor. Welcome. Here he is. There he is. There's also a paper from him. And then you've got the presentation of the FFC and the resource document, this one, the green one. Dr. Brown, over to you. We're going to listen to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So firstly, I think just to note, I think everyone is aware that we are making this submission in terms of the various pieces of legislation. As the chair has correctly articulated, we are in a time of a fiscally constrained environment, and this publication specifically, the 1921, has a look at the IGFR system and re-engineering that for national development. So our focus then has been on the IGFR system, looking at the performance and the effectiveness of that in order to see what we would want to recommend in terms of fiscal instruments and incentives, etc., in order to assist in the realization of the goals of the NDP. Essentially, we have this submission which follows up on the three previous submissions of the FFC. Back in 2016, the focus was on rural development, 2017 on urban development, and in the previous year it was on infrastructure, and particularly the importance of infrastructure as it pertains to the development, to employment specifically, and to addressing poverty and inequality. So this particular submission has six chapters. The first chapter is focused more specifically on making a case for re-engineering the IGFR. The second chapter looks at re-centralization of functions from the sub-national levels to the national level, and whether or not we find evidence for improvements with such function shifts. And we look there both at fiscal re-centralization, where the money moves, or control of the money moves, and then also administrative re-centralization, where the actual service delivery is moving. In terms of the next chapter, we look at health specifically, with the aim of looking at what the fiscal adjustment mechanisms are there and how they work within this fiscally constrained environment. Moving on then to chapter four, we go and look specifically at the intergovernmental grant system and looking at equitable share and then also the conditional grants, and looking at the incentive effects within those and the responses then to the fiscal constraint and how that impacts on those institutions that are getting those grants, particularly in this case the municipalities. Then we look at the infrastructure sector and look at the response there to the fiscal constraint, looking at the cases of health, education and transport, and seeing whether or not the cuts on infrastructure have had an impact on service delivery.
And welcome, then, welcome, Professor Plaatjes. A bit delayed, but you're here. Welcome.
Okay. And then the final chapter looks at the water sector and looks at the instruments that have been used in the water sector to manage the water sector and what the effectiveness has been there. So in terms of the first chapter, we look there, there's an econometric model that we've used. We look at the performance, past performance of the economy, look at the power projections of the economy going forward, broadly conclude that if we are on the same path, it's not going to take us to where we need to be. And then look at, from a statistical and econometric point of view, at the level of aggregate consumption that needs to change and the distributional effects of that impacting then on poverty and inequality. So we all know, I think, that since the 2008-09 global economic and financial crisis, the economic recovery has been slow. I think those that have been around a little bit longer will remember that initially at that time, economists were unclear as to whether this was a temporary correction, or we now know that it was a structural break in the economic trajectory. So it's now known as the 2009 Great Recession. But in South Africa, initially, we ran counter-cyclical fiscal policy. In other words, we ran a budget that still continued to grow spending as a counter-cyclical measure. I think beyond 2013, in terms of budgets, it became clear that there's a structural break and that in actual fact, we're not going to recoup that growth as projected, and hence there have been the fiscal constraints, the narrowing of the fiscal gap, and in actual fact, I suppose now we would say there's a negative fiscal gap. If we go then over to the graph, what we can see is that our growth prospects in South Africa are not good, relatively speaking. If we compare ourselves to the world on average, emerging markets and in sub-Saharan Africa, and we have a particular problem in our economy because we are not generating employment. So, for example, in 2017, there were 201,000 new job market entrants and only 102,000 absorptions. So the unemployment is growing, and obviously that has an impact then, which is our explicit concern on poverty and inequality. So from a budget point of view, I suppose the key indicator to watch is the budget deficit, the extent to which spending exceeds revenue. And particularly, we know that the budget deficit has been growing for each of the successive years. And in the most recent budgets, what we see is that always in the outer year forecast, we see the first time that the deficit will actually be less than the year before. But in successive budgets, that has constantly been pushed out. So we're never getting to the point where the deficit of a particular year is actually smaller than the year before. We need to get to the point where it's smaller than the year before, and then we need to get to a point where there isn't a deficit in a particular year. Because every year that there is a deficit, then obviously there's an addition to debt. The problem with the addition to the debt is the interest payments on the debt, first and foremostly, and then obviously we also need to get to a point where we start paying the debt back and not adding to debt. The interest payments in this current fiscal year already sit at 170 billion. So this is a huge problem, and this is not even paying back the debt. That's money that could have been used for service delivery. So fiscally speaking, we are very much in a jam relative to where we would have been, say, 10 years ago. Revenue connection, as you know, is not what it should be. And in last year, there was 36 billion under collection, cuts in spending of 26 billion. But that might sound like good news on the spending side, but then that means that the other was adding to the deficit. So either which way, we're in a jam. And particularly for the FFC, we're interested in the service delivery impacts of this fiscal framework. And I think we have noted very explicitly as the FFC that we are concerned by the cuts on infrastructure budgets, as we do understand that there's underspending in some of the infrastructure. So if you're going to cut a budget, maybe best to cut it where you know it won't be spent. Or where it could be rescheduled, so there is a rationale for that. But on the other hand, the country has such a big infrastructure backlog, and particularly as it pertains to generating economic growth, we are concerned about that. So I think on the last slide there that I'm going to talk to, we are basically saying that business as usual is not going to assist us here, and if we particularly want to focus, and this is what we did in our economic modeling, we said let us focus on the sustainable development goals of reducing poverty to half and of eliminating hunger, and then let's see which what we need in terms of growth. What changes do we need? In our estimation then, if we halve poverty, it would take it down to 27.5%. In order to do that, we need to lift growth from our projections of roughly 2% to 4.5%, so it's a tall order. We would also then need to have an increase in investment to the extent of about 5.7%, and consumption expenditure would also need to increase by about 2.5%. But in addition to that, if we look at the normal distributional flows that would come from that consumption spending, we would also need to add, for example, a measure like a 10% increase in social grants in order to make sure that we have that pointed and specific effect in terms of the rural economic spaces. And particularly in doing so, we need to also focus on increasing the level of skills, because the absorption for employment is in the higher skills. So the rest of the submission then, after having broadly speaking on a higher level made a case for the fact that the fiscal framework space needs to be shifted, the rest of the chapters then focus more specifically on particular areas of the budget and looking at specific changes that are required there. I'm going to hand over now very briefly to Mr. Tseng, who will talk to the next slide. And between Mr. Tseng and Ms. Ntaka, yeah, they'll complete the rest of the presentation.
Honourable Chair, honourable members, first of all, it's my apology for coming in a bit late. The next slide is just a very quick overview of the socioeconomic profiles of provinces, just for information, capturing some of the social eco bases as well as facts on the ground, so to speak. Next slide. So with the backdrop of a protracted, decelerated economic growth, narrowing fiscal space and weakened governance, as the IMF alarmingly concluded in the 2018 Article 4 consultation, and I quote, "Some of South Africa's economic and social achievements after the end of apartheid have recently unwound." Chapter 2, which is right after my short session, of the FFC submission for the 2019-20 Division of Revenue is on fiscal re-centralization, implications for service delivery and intergovernmental fiscal relations. By way of introduction, supported by RAND evidence, as it is in front of you, and as Honorable Chair said, follow the money. Table presents the comparison between the 2017 and 18 budgets for the 2018-19 and 19-20 financial years by spheres of government. The data shows that provincial and local spheres of government, especially provincial and local conditional grants, they're the brunt of the fiscal consolidation efforts in the 18-19 financial year. More specifically, total appropriation by national votes, the top line, basically national sphere of government before direct charges was only reduced by 1.568 billion in the 2018 budgets compared to the 2017 budgets for that 18-19 financial year. In contrast, provincial government transfers were reduced by 1.2 billion and 6.4 billion for equitable share and conditional grants respectively, and local government transfers, mainly just conditional grants, by 3 billion reduction. In the 19-20 financial year, that is to the right side of the table, data suggests that additional funding for national departments of 17.7 billion, the addition, mainly for higher education and training, as we know, and the total main budget expenditure reduction of 19.621 billion, that is at the bottom line there, were mainly the result of a combination of factors. Money, first of all, money reprioritized from provisional allocations for contingencies not assigned to boats at 12.258 billion, a reduction of contingency reserve at 12 billion, as well as a reduction in the subnational spheres of governments, with provincial governments' equitable share at 1 billion reduction, conditional grants at 7.55 billion, and local government by 3.6 billion. Hence, the fiscal re-centralization personified or modified, if you will. I now shall hand over to Poppy to present on Chapter 2, fiscal re-centralization and its implications.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson, and good morning, Honorable members and other colleagues. I will take you through Chapter 2 and Chapter 3 of our submission. Chapter 2 of the submission concerns re-centralization, where re-centralization is essentially a reform that brings about a reduction in autonomy of subnational governments. So basically it refers to an increasing role and control of national governments. And examples of re-centralization or of the national government expanding its footprint would include the shifting of functions from the subnational government to the national sphere. So examples would be shifting of the social security grants from provinces to SASA, and another case would be the case of the TVET colleges that were shifted from the provincial education departments to the National Department of Higher Education and Training in 2012. Or rather, in a financial sense, then it also occurs when there is a reduction in the autonomy of subnational governments over their fiscal resources. So when we start seeing excessive use of conditional grants over, or rather relative to the streams of revenue that subnational governments would have discretion over. So now, re-centralization is often based on the perception that national government is better at service delivery or ensuring that results are achieved. And from our analysis, it appears that governments are more prone to re-centralize during times of fiscal stress. But however, re-centralization raises various concerns. One such concern is that it runs contrary to the spirit and the principles underpinning our multi-level government system. System of government. And so if you look at it this way, if it was the case that national government was increasing its expanding its footprint or increasing its role, and we were seeing improved cost-efficient service delivery, but this was happening alongside the upscaling of subnational government capacity, then maybe there would be a case for re-centralization, or we would say it's more justified. Another concern is that the relocation of a function comes with financial implications for both the sphere gaining and the one losing. So the key question of this chapter is whether re-centralization is a solution for South Africa during times of fiscal stress. Will it lead to better performance and better service delivery? And to answer this question, we focused on two case studies of re-centralization. As mentioned earlier, two case studies of administrative re-centralization and fiscal re-centralization. The case study of fiscal re-centralization, we looked at earmarked conditional grants, which are essentially a ring-fenced pocket of funding within the conditional grant that has very stringent conditions attached to it. So essentially, it reduces the autonomy of subnational governments over fiscal resources. So it's a subtle approach to centralizing. And we looked at two of these earmarked conditional grants. We looked at the finance-linked income subsidy program, the FLISP, and the upgrading of informal settlements, mining towns grants. Then the second case study that we focused on was for a perspective of the administrative re-centralization. We looked at the TVET colleges, which were shifted from the provinces to national in 2012. So in terms of our key findings, broadly speaking, there has been a slight change in the way in which government responds to during times of fiscal stress. If we look at the graph on the current slide, which illustrates the real growth of block grants against the conditional grants for the period 2003-04 to 2019-20. We see that the period post the financial crisis, we see that national government is expanding its footprint, which is evident in the real growth of conditional grants. Relative to your more muted, even declining growth in your block grants or your discretionary funds such as the PES and the LES. And then if we contrast that now with the period 2015-16 up until the current MTF, which is also characterized by low growth, we see that the response has been quite different. We see that block grants now show a positive growth relative to your conditional grant funding, but what is interesting here is that whilst the number of the conditional grants are not growing as rapidly, we see a growth in the number of earmark grants, which again, as I explained earlier, it's the pockets of funding within the existing conditional grants that have strict conditions attached to them. So again, a more subtle approach to centralizing fiscal control over subnational governments. Then in terms of the second finding, it relates to the earmarked funds within the human settlements related grants. With respect to their spending and their service delivery performance, our analysis found that national government is not necessarily better, thus bringing into question the rationale behind decentralization. So for example, with the FLISP, we see high levels of underspending. In 2016-2017, it was around 76%, and similar performance for the grants and the upgrading of informal settlements in mining towns. In terms of the service delivery performance, the mining towns grant shows that at 2016-17, only about 41% of the targeted sites were actually were upgraded. And then in terms of our third finding, which is derived from the case study on seabed colleges, as you will remember, the colleges were relocated to the national sphere in 2012. We evaluated the efficiency of these colleges prior to and post the relocation of the function. And we found that, yes, there were some colleges that were inefficient previously and then improved post the reform. But worryingly, there were then some other colleges that were doing well under provinces, and post the reform, they saw a decline in their efficiency. So that's implying that taking a blanket approach to the reform or re-centralization is not ideal, as it can negatively affect your good performance. So based on these findings, the Commission makes three recommendations. The first one being that in the current constrained economic environment and with limited resources, government should then not automatically resort to increasing the role of national government. The second recommendation is that to improve service delivery and attainment of specific priority outcomes, control measures other than the implementation of earmark conditional grants funding must be developed and strengthened. And then thirdly, in instances where it is deemed necessary to re-centralize a function, a differentiated approach must be adopted. Moving on to the third chapter, which looked at the provincial fiscal adjustment mechanisms in provincial health departments. And in understanding that your provinces play a crucial role in the delivery of primary health care with health allocations comprising between 30-35% of the total provincial budgets, we see that poor health, the provincial health departments appear to be under severe pressure as a result of massive demands coupled with poor growth in transfers. So it's estimated that the current health budget is underfunded by 13 billion in 2018. So in this context of the existing tight fiscal environments, which places healthcare delivery under severe pressure, this analysis then asks what means are available to two provinces to respond to this ongoing strain. And so the first thing that we did was to assess whether intergovernmental fiscal arrangements provide scope for provinces to adjust their budgets in times of fiscal constraints. What we found is that firstly, a sizable portion of the provincial revenues made up of earmarked national transfers, and this hampers the ability of provinces to adjust their spending priorities in line with fiscal position. And also, existing intergovernmental fiscal arrangements also limit the scope for provincial borrowing or revenue side measures. As you know, provinces have limited revenue-raising powers and functions compared to or relative to your municipalities. So all in all, existing intergovernmental fiscal arrangements limit the ability of provinces to adjust their budgets in times of fiscal constraints. Then secondly, we wanted to assess the extent of fiscal stress on provincial health departments. And to do this, we used the budget balance as a measure and used it as a measure. And generally, where budgets are under stress, we would see a negative budget balance or underspend or overspending, which is indicative of stress. And then so the figure on this slide shows the provincial budget analysis for three provinces, Gauteng, the KwaZulu-Natal, and Eastern Cape between 2002 and 2016. With the exception of KwaZulu-Natal, generally the balance fluctuates above the accepted threshold of zero, indicating then a positive cash balance or underspending, which then dispels the notion that fiscal pressure exists, well, at least from the context of the budget balance. And then when we dug a bit deeper, we found that provinces were actually masking this overspending through an accounting procedure known as expenditure accruals, where expenditure accruals are essentially expenses that will then be deducted from the following year's budget, which is not a very financially, not a very prudent way to plug a fiscal gap. As at 2016-17, expenditure accruals in the health sector amounted to 13.8 billion rand. And so why do provinces do this? Overspending is deemed as unauthorized and can be treated as a direct charge against the department's future budget allocations. So the use of expenditure accruals masks overspending as a way of provinces to get around this challenge. And the second reason is that from a constitutional and a human rights perspective, in the case where a patient presents themselves for treatment, you can't turn them away because there's no money. So provincial health departments then have to commit to underfunded spending or the use of your expenditure accruals to minimize legal claims. So essentially what we're sitting with is that we're sitting with a problem whereby provinces are saying provincial healthcare delivery is under pressure, where the source of this pressure is inadequate funding or inadequate transfers, and they need more money. Whereas from the other side, the national agrees that this is the case, that health budgets are under pressure, but it's not because it's too little, it's insufficient, but rather it's as a result of mismanagement and inefficiencies. So in terms of our recommendations as a commission, we are saying that we need clearer signaling of when provinces, provincial health departments are under pressure, and therefore we recommend that a framework or a criteria for determining serious financial strain with clear measurable financial and non-financial factors needs to be developed. Then secondly, we need a solution for addressing the significant expenditure accruals that exist. So to this end, we recommend that the National Treasury and the Department of Health allocate part of the 2018-19 MTF health infrastructure budget towards gradually offsetting the expenditure accruals. And then the third recommendation is about building in some sort of space or flexibility in the system to ensure that the provincial health departments have some cushioning during times of fiscal stress. And so we therefore recommend that the Minister of Finance, through the National Treasury, accommodates this. We should ensure that the framework of the health infrastructure conditional grant accommodates this flexibility. With your permission, Chair, if I may hand over to my colleague who will then take you through the rest of the presentation.
You're welcome. Rashid.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. So Chapter 4, the next chapter, is an econometric attempt at analysing the incentive effect of intergovernmental grants of local governments, both equitable share as unconditional or block grants and conditional grants. This graph shows that real growth in intergovernmental transfers have slowed significantly in the past decade or so, which raises two competing views. On the one hand, the reductions on these local government transfers may create incentives for municipalities to be more autonomous in own revenue generation. However, it may also worsen service delivery inequality for the already fragile municipalities lacking revenue base on the other. Next slide, please. Hence, this chapter is seeking empirical evidence, just summarizing all that methodological approach, empirical evidence on the relationship between intergovernmental grants, funding, equitable share and conditional grants, and municipal own revenue generation in a very generalized sense. Next slide. The results, given how diverse and unequal, frankly, the local social economic basis are in South Africa, perhaps not surprisingly, the result is mixed. Different transfers may have different impact on municipal own revenue generation based on the category of the municipality. More succinctly, summarizing the key points on the slide, is that local government conditional grants are positively correlated with more urbanized municipalities, while local government equitable shares transfers are apparent reinforcers for own revenue in more rural municipalities. Next slide. Hence, our recommendations are, firstly, keep greater flexibility to rural municipalities in terms of the use of grants, but with monitoring, to derive and encourage this local solutions for solving local problems approach. Secondly, introduce a fiscal capacity component in the local government equitable share formula, taking into account the revenue-raising efforts and horizontal imbalances of municipalities. The next chapter, next slide, Chapter 5, is assessing provincial infrastructure programs. We know that, and we saw earlier again, that over the 2018 MTF, government has cut funding to key provincial infrastructure programs. However, there is little doubt, if any, that successful delivery of infrastructure projects is critical for service delivery and economic growth. By using a combination of budget analysis, surveys, and interviews conducted with stakeholders and contractors, this chapter examines the type and extent of inefficiencies in provincial infrastructure spending for health, education, and transport. Next slide. Our analysis showed that cuts to baseline infrastructure funding slow down infrastructure delivery in the short run. In the medium run, with sufficient built personnel and procurement, provinces seem to be able to absorb the cuts through efficiency gains. It is also found that separations between sector departments and implementing agents distort incentives and weaken the accountability chain. The survey conducted on the contractors showed that as high as 91% of contractors in our sample felt government procurement processes are not transparent. 57% see corruption as prominent during the procurement and tender phases of the infrastructure cycle. 76% of the contractors said they have made 3 to as high as 12% of the contract value in informal payments to secure, just to secure, a contract with government. Next slide. further insights from the study of the infrastructure value chain reveal that a lack of oversight at key delivery points leads to gaps for fiscal misappropriation and, of course, which results in inefficiencies. More specifically, consultants tend to over-design and over-cost projects since their commissions are a percentage of the project cost. There is no objective third party to review the tender awarding process, no proper grading or proven track record resulting in hidden inefficiencies. And lastly, absent supervision, resulting in people taking shortcuts, concealed defects, and use of inferior materials. These are obviously issues at the ground level that it happens. Hence, recommendations include sector departments develop clear performance evaluation frameworks on infrastructure projects and provisions, as well as greater scrutiny of requisition variation orders. For example, examining the infrastructure reporting model, the IRM data of the Infrastructure Delivery Management System, IDMS, would be a step in the right direction and one that we, the FFC, is currently taking. From the funding side, the assessment criteria for infrastructure incentives should be made more incentivizing and any cuts or shifts be made more transparent on the incentivized grants such as the EIG, infrastructure, education infrastructure grants and the health revitalization grants. Our last chapter is on water. Chapter 6 is on water in the IGFR system. Although since the advent of democracy, South Africa has been quite successful in expanding access to basic services, with water being one of them. However, challenges remain in terms of water quality, reliability, security, and efficiency. Table shows that physically, nearly all households have minimum standard of water infrastructure, but less have functioning, reliable services, and worse, often unsatisfactory sanitation and no data for water safety at all. On the funding side, we see a mixture of various funding channels. We have equitable share for basic services, regional bulk infrastructure grants for new water and sanitation infrastructure upgrades, municipal infrastructure grants for funding capital costs and backlogs, and water services infrastructure grants for water services authorities. So one may say it's maybe too convoluted and almost too much detail. Our research shows, next slide. Our research shows that despite significant spending of these grants, or commitment of these grants, access to safe and reliable water services is still declining. Inadequate expenditure focus of the IGFR system on operations and maintenance is leading to service failures. Combined with limited revenue collection, aggravates municipal water board and the national department's financial deficit. Next slide. In terms of municipal transfers and the fiscus, poorly defined grant objectives result in substantial deviations from policy, which also mars accountability. Many municipalities do not pursue cost reflectiveness and cost recovery for services provided. The result is, putting timelines here, is poor quality of service provided in the short term, inadequate funds to maintain infrastructure in the medium term, which leads to high levels of infrastructure system failures in the long term. Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, ladies and gentlemen, our Chapter 6 on Water recommends that Department of Water and Sanitation reviews the basic norms and standards together with the associated local government equitable share transfers with National Treasury. Municipalities, through Water Services Development Plan, monitor their water standards and how capital, operational, and, most importantly, maintenance costs are funded. Grants, objectives, and conditions should be attached to financial transfers, and that funding should be withheld from municipalities who do not measure to monitor and control water consumption. Overall, the IGFR system should shift towards incentivizing sustainable operations and maintenance and introduce a dimension, the dimension of outcome-based support for higher levels of service. I now hand over to our CEO, Dr. Brown, to conclude.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. In a nutshell, I think we're focusing on efficiency, efficiency, efficiency at various levels. First, in the submission, we started out at the more macro level and saying that in South Africa, we need to properly understand our economic challenges and more specifically understand how we plan to address them. With a more purposeful and focused intent, need to focus our budgets and our efforts on that, and particularly, obviously, government as well. Secondly, critical is that in making the necessary changes, we need to be mindful of the precarious fiscal position so that we focus on redress as far as poverty and inequality is concerned, but that we do so in a way when we restructure the economy that is sustainable for the fiscus. And then thirdly, as depicted in some of the later chapters in the submission, we focus on the efficiency in particular government sectors. The efficiencies then often relate not only to a particular sector, but often also to a related sector. So we also want to draw attention to the fact that there need to be some efficiencies, particularly in the coordination of activities, with the key focus on addressing poverty and inequality. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. Professor Blakies. That's the presentation. Members, that's the presentation. There you have it, members. As I said in my introduction, what we experienced during our oversight in various provinces and specific municipalities is actually also captured here in your assessment on the case studies you did. Efficiency of all government activity. That's a crucial sentence. And then you need expertise to do what is supposed to be done. Water leakage have to be addressed and fixed at least in 36 hours, not 14 days. Yes. Back to basics program. I still remember that presentation. All the members' questions? Excuse me. About Montreal Shipping. About Blanche. Yes, sir. About Samandi. In that order.
Distribute us but out of the we ran out of brain paper, so the procurement of parliament takes a bit of time.
We'll have to address that. We will have to address it. You are a valuable member of this committee. We will have to address it.
FFC one about that also.
Excuse me. In that order, you may start a little bit more on shipping.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Maybe good morning, ladies and gentlemen. let me welcome the presentation. Straightforward and at least it's giving me a certain light in terms of how, in the direction that we need to take as a country. However, Chair, these institutions like FFC have been created specifically to make such recommendations to inform us to address the terrible challenges facing this country of inequality, unemployment, and poverty. Since 2014, Chair, there has been quite a number of recommendations. I wonder, because my recollection of facts is that one area that was identified, I don't know how it was characterized, but I know the emphasis was placed on addressing issues that relates to early childhood learning, and that's where the investment had to lie. You know, at times when you make recommendations, it's important that you begin to come with what is the impact of the recommendation or the assessment that we have made, or the finding that we have made, that the country should invest towards that direction. You made quite a number of interesting projections in terms of the economic growth. However, one area that is very worrisome to me is the fact that, and if you may prove me wrong, which projection that you made has ever been met since I came here in 2014? Because you make quite an, you know, interesting projections, and the result doesn't show, and I take it for, that it's you took your time and researched very wonderfully around your projections of the economic growth. Chair, on slide 9. In terms of recentralization, well, they came up with that recentralization would not be, as I understood, would not be the only methodology to be applied, though it's listed in terms of your 6 areas that you are looking into. I'm just worried about your analysis that National is doing well in terms of its expenditure, but I see doing well in terms of transferring the funds, because they are not at the coal face of service delivery. Are you talking in terms of the monies that are transferred from national to province and local? And on those basis, you say, no, it's doing very well in terms of... And did you look into when you were making this assumption in terms of powers and functions, in terms of recentralization? Chair, let me make my last point. Yes, on shifting the funds from infrastructural development to service accruals. You know, the National Council of Provinces has a program called Taking Parliament to the People, has provincial weeks, wherein we physically go to areas and look into these issues. We went to Free State, Eastern Cape, and now recently to Gauteng. Recent visits. The state of our health facilities. Because if we would redirect the funds and leave the infrastructure, where will the services be provided? Because the services that needs to be provided of health needs to be provided in an infrastructure that is conducive to provide for such services. I'm just wondering. Because the infrastructure is dilapidated and it deserves much. And if you recommend or make a proposal that funds needs to be redirected, I'm a little bit worried with that. You may respond to the chair, because chair, my time is up. Thank you very much. You'll brief me.
I'll go to Blanche.
Chairperson, thank you. Let me also start by appreciating the presentation, and I really agree with the good doctor's summary about efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. You know, my colleague touched on visits that we did, oversight visits that we did all across the country. And one of the things that really came out, and it's always coming out, is the, what, you know, maybe this is a strong term, is, yeah, the inability, or let's say inefficiency, you know, how capital projects are executed by government. You know, really, a lot of money is wasted. Wasted due to the inability that, you know, we don't have a proper, you know, first of all, supply chain management, people, contract management, stuff like that, and projects management on site. A lot of money gets lost, even I'm daring to say gets stolen by corruption and stuff like that with infrastructure. Then, you know, a big problem is also, and I just want, you know, maybe a little bit of comment on that, you know, a lot of money is also wasted with fruitless, wasteful, and, you know, unauthorized expenditure. So that is areas, I think, that can be jacked up quite a bit, and quite a bit of savings can be affected. Something that worries me a bit, and maybe I can also be informed about a little bit more, with this re-centralization, the term that you are using, I have a concern that apparently there is an expectation that local governments or municipalities, what we decided yesterday on that term, apparently there is an expectation that they will be able to raise more funds. Now, if they are going to do that, it means that the citizens are going to be taxed even more. Fact of the matter is they can only raise additional funding, you know, by selling electricity and, you know, obviously the payment of, you know, rates and taxes on their properties. And that is a serious concern to me. The in-pocket situation of our citizens, chairperson, is really not that good anymore. And, you know, we cannot come with unnecessary additional taxes. Chairperson, then, I think this is a very good presentation. So please, that is the premise where I'm moving from. The thing that I think is lacking a bit, and maybe that was not part, Professor, of the brief or whatever, you know, things that need to be done by government in terms of policy certainty, that is a great impediment for investment in this country. So we need to address that as well. You know, we seem to be dwelling on the practical things that is happening on the ground, but, you know, the things, as I said, policy certainty, stuff like that, I don't really see here. Chairperson, I think for now, this is my input. Thank you so much. Thank you.
The 24th of October, the afternoon to 14 hours, will be a very important session in South Africa where the Minister of Finance will table the MTPBS and will definitely address the issue of policy. Honorable Isaac.
Chairperson, thanks for the opportunity. It's always great to receive a presentation by the FFC because it kind of lends a lot of food for thought in terms of looking at circumstances objectively and applying one's mind. And I recall Honorable Plankis, sometimes when his blood pressure goes up and he says, "You politicians, why don't you guys interrogate this thing? Why don't we are guiding you, ask the questions, find the solutions. You are the politicians. So, yes, Mr. Blake, I will always recall that, and I am indeed very grateful for your guidance and your submissions. I think it's fantastic to always have FFC and your team. Yeah, absolutely. Chairperson, a lot has been raised by my colleagues, and I'm just going to try and avoid what has been raised. The question always comes to mind when I hear the FFC's submissions, specifically twice a year before the budgets. I always ask myself, and I ask my colleagues, why, Chairperson, what happened? What happened? Why are we here discussing these kind of depressive scenarios? Who is to blame? Who does the buck stop with? I think it begins with us as politicians. It is committees like this that give direction. It is committees like this, we are legislatures. This scenario is absolutely the buck stops with us. But be that as it may be, the question here currently is, in your opinion, Mr. Blake, is who and when does someone begin to pay heed to what you are saying? Because really, you've warned us, you've been telling us about the scenarios of the last 4 or 5 years very clearly. So, when I sit in committees and we interrogate, together with the rest of my colleagues, when we interrogate provincial governments that come and show us their spending and how great a job they are doing, the impression and the scenario is created, oh, the spend is great, the spend is great. We're doing a fantastic job, we spend 90% of the budget. And then you look at your presentation and you talk of the accruals and how things are fictitiously engineered that we're doing a great job. So the question arises is, you know, spending is one thing, but spending effectively is another scenario. And I think we should begin to take cognizance, because really we are where we are purely because of our own doings. 170 billion rand in interest spent alone. 170 billion rand in interest spent alone, year on year. I mean, in terms of our GDP and the non-growth, so we're headed for a bit of a train smash. Now, I'll just come to two quick questions, and then I will allow Honorable Nzimande to take over. On chapter 3, I think it was slide 13, you mentioned that provinces need to adjust their budgets accordingly, but provinces lack the necessary levers. Now, my question is, where do we take this to from here? Who, in your opinion, does what? What do you suggest? Who should I, as a legislator, as a politician, go to, ask the certain questions to, and hold responsible? Whether shall I go to National Treasury? Shall I go to the minister? I need some guidance on that point in chapter 3. And then, lastly, Chairperson, that I'll do as a written question. That one I'll do as a written question. We'll have to interrogate that. And then finally, Chairperson, there's so many. Oh, yeah. On chapter 5, page 22, the last bullet, when you talk about the assessment you have done in terms and investigations the FFC has done regarding the contracts in terms of informal payments. Now, we all know where the 10 or the 12% goes to. That is common knowledge today. But the question arises, at the end of the day, it is the taxpayer that has to bear the brunt, and in terms of quality, etc. Again, the FFC is making certain recommendations. To what extent do we take heed? Have you been talking to National Treasury about this? Thank you, Chair.
In terms of the PFMA, the buck stops with the accounting officer and the political head of a department. That's the minister or the MEC.
know.
It's here.
We know that.
Well, then we must implement what we know. Then we must implement what we know. Honorable Samandi?
Honorable Success is allowing me. No, I thought you were the only chair, Honorable. So he's abusing his opportunity, but no, thank you, Chair. Chairperson, I think my colleagues really engaged and interacted with the presentation, and as they expressed the level of informativity of these presentations and that we get, and the studies that FFC conducts, I think, Chair, they do help. But I think we are in a conundrum with this one, in a sense that as you opened the meeting with your remarks, saying that we follow the money, but there are huge instances when we follow the money that we find question of capacity and the ability, and therefore when we see this concern on chapter 2 and 3 of the presentation on reclassification, then one is just stays with the question, remains with the question, what then, you know, what now? Because if we take the history of the ACID grant, Chair, that how badly it's been expanded, and, I mean, for years, taken from that other province, Eastern Cape, and one or two other provinces that have continuously been culprits in implementing the new grant, that we've just been dealing with the early childhood development grant. Our observation there, Chair, is that provinces, I mean, they were given all the mechanisms, the plan, agreed, you will set up this structure, the projects, you get people to run the project within yourselves, you just come and access the money. But when they came here and we interrogated them, some of them had no plans. They didn't even heed to the conditions of the grant. They came here and said, "No, we are dealing with the mud structure of the crutches in the Eastern Cape and somewhere else." So I'm saying it's a real conundrum, Chair, in a sense that so perhaps, you know, as they might want to share with us, the FFC, then the assumption was based on the evidence that the case that they are making, as the report is saying, but this assumption is sufficiently evidenced that in the era we're in of the fiscal constraint, and where control must be done, and where there's ballooning irregular expenditures in the billions, so what then? And so what do we do? So the assumption itself, is it well based, evidently, you know, to make it as a concern as they raise it. Secondly, Chair, the redirecting of funds, and also it becomes part of a concern that there's the redirecting of funds, and they made a deal of work around the health situation. And Chair, all the time when we discuss health, the medical claims becomes the key question that is always unanswered, and they are a serious threat to the budget of health, the budget allocation of health, so to speak. Therefore, you know, an ability to redirect and all this, and I just a clarity there, Chair, that in their view, it's not that the redirecting of health. Maybe they want to say that their case should, the case is that it should not be, I mean, it should be limited. I don't know, just if they may comment by giving more clarity in terms of what this concern on redirecting of funds and national national government being a player there. With the equitable share also, I think it's something to underscore that this question, the FFC has always, been on this case. And I think I'm from where we sit as a committee, I think it's the movement towards resolving this issue of the equitable share. I think it's just too slow. And now versus the question of reclassification and all this. But also related to this, Chair, in the terms of the adjustments and things like that, the question of concurrence, have we dealt with the question of functions of concurrence? I think Mutla Shuping tried to point something around the analysis and the assessment of the functions, the separation of functions in terms of the IGR and your public PFMA as such. But I think Chair, comment would also help, in the question then, because they raised the issue of education and health, but there are issues of concurrence. And yet the other part of the partner of concurrence is playing ball. If you come here and get your province chair saying that they've built an hospital but there's no money for it to operate. Mm-hmm. That they told us on record, yeah. So where do we stand? And there's the issue of concurrence there, there's the issue of redirecting the funds, and the issue of building your own revenue, and all this and all that. So I think, Chair, it's, as I said earlier, and joining my colleagues, it's really an informative presentation. And I guess, Chair, a good platform for policy debates and leading to how we influence policy changes and choices that must be made. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Simandi. Very good remarks you made, Honourable Monakiri.
Thanks, Chair. I also want to welcome the presentation, which indeed has been very informative, very helpful. I've got one or two points to raise. The first is with regard to the issue of re-centralization that they have highlighted. And what just want to indicate that I think they've been able to make a case for this to be seriously considered given the serious inefficiencies in service delivery at various spheres of government and also challenges of mismanagement as far as finances are concerned. So I'm just highlighting this point to say that I think indeed it's something that needs to be seriously considered. And also the fact that our government, especially municipalities, should indeed be encouraged to provide services above basic service level so that they're able to then collect some revenue which can then be used to maintain the infrastructure that is there. Because if there's no collection, that infrastructure will actually decay and affect service delivery and will end up with all these protests that we have seen mushrooming everywhere. So I think they are in the right direction as far as that is concerned. An area which I want them to comment on is with regard to economic growth. I think they have highlighted this particular point to say that at the center of the crisis that we are dealing with is this low economic growth. But in terms of their recommendations, they have not come out very clear as to exactly what measures, what intervention are they, you know, proposing to make sure that we actually boost economic growth in the country so that we're able to deal with all the challenges. Without that economic growth, we always, I mean, for a long time, remain in this particular situation. So I just want to the Commission to actually come back and perhaps just elaborate further in terms of their recommendations. Where do they think there is a possibility of this particular challenge being addressed as far as their recommendations are concerned? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Nakeni. Your recommendations and the package that was announced by His Excellency the President to revive the economy. Can you make an input on that? And then on page seven, socioeconomic and fiscal profiles of provinces, maybe you just named it, but can you elaborate on that as well? I think Mr. Singh, you dealt with page seven. Slide 16, bullet number two, the second line. Ministers should allocate part of the 2019-18 MTF. Is it not 18-19? Yeah, just look at that one. Slide 22, 23. Challenges that arise due to the lack of oversight. We visited a district municipality in the Eastern Cape, and some of the members serving in that council saw some of the projects for the first time, but was elected in 2016. Yes, that's what we come across when we do our oversight. Provinces. Thank you, Prof. You and your team can reply.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members. Just to let you know, part of the reasons why I'm late, and I hope the CEO explain to you. It's just the time that changes to get to the other committee. Let me just respond to the Chairperson on the first thing that you raised. Presidential summit, and I want to add on that presidential fiscal stimulus, rather, yeah. And the job summit. We're preparing our responses to that relative to the NTBBS. So if you can call us back on it, post the NTBBS, then we will be able to connect all these things for you, because we haven't as yet looked at all these things, because we're preparing for a number of things that. You will include it in that presentation, and we'll give you our responses to it. So that's the job summit, that's the fiscal stimulus, and probably the presidential national health insurance summit. So there's a couple of things that's going to be packaged in that as part of a looking at the fiscal incentives that's been provided, but also what it means for the economy, for economic and social development, and also infrastructure issues. So if you can just bear with us and hold on that one. And then I'm taking it backwards to Honorable Molokeza's point that he made, the measures of interventions to boost the economy. And I'm going to come back to the point that that I raise continuously in this meeting when I meet with Parliament committees and on behalf of the FFC, because it all hinges on that. The measures for interventions to boost the economy, and what we are saying about it is that we have given this honourable place a submission that spoke to infrastructure-led growth, where we argue that investment in infrastructure is going to lead to economic growth, it's going to attract investment if government first invest in it, because people first want to see whether you're going to take the risk for investment before they come and do the investment. you also raised in there, how it can help with dealing with the employment, unemployment pressure on it, and how within each budget one needs to look at what each vote is doing with regard to infrastructure investment, which will lead to economic growth, social human capital development, but also economic growth. That was followed by rural development submission, where we looked at investment in the rural, what we call in South Africa rural areas, because the definitions are quite fluid. Because if you move just outside, if you're in the Western Cape, you just move beyond the toll, the Deutschgruf, people will say that's rural, you know, and on the other side, you move beyond Grabow, people will say it's rural. But if you look at the conditions before that, you can also say part of those areas are rural. So we did a, and then you can do it the same, Carltonville, you know, Gauteng, and so on and so forth. So we did a submission that spoke to the rural development phenomena. Now that will create rural economies, but also better conditions for people in those rural areas. And then we fast-tracked that to the one before this, where we spoke about urban development and urbanization. And in that we argued very strongly that metros are going to be the engines of development. And in fact, the world over, the cities, the metros are becoming the engines of development. And the second tier, if you like, or the sphere of government gets many times ignored because people go to where the decision making is of much greater. It's like, for instance, property taxes and property rates and land allocation and land rules and land utilization. Are not made by provincial governments, made by municipalities. And changing of the spatial spaces, and whether it's going from agriculture to other industrial development, that's made by municipalities. So we push that on. So that's the point I'm making. So there's a set of recommendations that we did bring to both the committees in NCOP and the committees in the NA. Now, here's the problem. I'm rushing out to the front of it. Here's the problem, and this is the issue that I keep on raising. We have made, before my time in the AFFC, till my time in the AFFC 2013, to the time that I was appointed full-time chair last year. So we've made substantive recommendations over these years. And the question is not about us determining what's the impact of it, because we can't determine the impact. If the committees in Parliament has not agreed and approved the recommendations. Now, I've been at pains to look at the different reports of different committees, because it's not this committee only that we're speaking to. And it's like that you've been heard, been listened to, you can ask questions of clarity and interrogation, but there's never in the report that we, let's say we give you 10 recommendations, that 4 of the recommendations you agree with and you're going to push those recommendations with one part, the Minister of Finance, who's the head of Treasury, or the provincial treasuries in terms of the MSCs of Treasury. In fact, yesterday I said former MEC says for my, you guys are going to do the section 100 again, you're going to sit with the same problem that we've had before. And the recommendations that we've making. Okay? So we know each other. I mean, honorable to be at home, we know from other activities in the 80s. But here's the thing is that we set those recommendations to you, both houses. And it's amazing that both houses ask us what's the impact of the recommendations. We are the only constitutional structure that is supposed to advise Parliament. The the only constitutional structure supposed to advise Parliament on economic, fiscal, social policies, and to be able to be for you an avant-garde in information for you then to determine whether what you've been provided to by departments in terms of their votes are correct, appropriate, relevant, and it will make changes to the system. And it will bring about, it will have those necessary impact on the lives of the poor, historically disadvantaged, given the deep levels of poverty, the deep levels of inequality and stubborn poverty that we currently deal with. Now, if you don't get parliamentarians who will be providing this information to accept or to reject our recommendations, then what is happening is that there's a compounded effect. Because we can go back to recommendations as was given to Parliament since the time I worked in Treasury in the 90s to the time I left Treasury and beyond that. Stacks and stacks of recommendations on different things. On higher education, we gave recommendations on it. And how to deal with the student, the looming student financial aid problem that's going to hit our country. We've dealt with that. And when fees must fall, we said, we've done this. In fact, when we went to the Hare Commission, we tabled what we presented to Parliament some time ago. And then there's so if Parliament doesn't, the different committees that we're talking about, because there's a two appropriations, I'm saying to you the same thing I said to yesterday's standing Mr. Sposa's committee. And to what I said to education and what I said to health before I came here. The story is, and I'm at this point saying to you, if Parliament doesn't believe that the Finance and Fiscal Commission is an appropriate institution to be able to bring these recommendations that will help Parliament to be able to interrogate adequately and properly what departments are saying, what the Treasury is saying, and what others bring before you. Because we sit here, Mrs. Honorable de Beerno, I sit sometimes in the corner and listen to people and other committees, and we see on TV, and that's not actually true what those people are saying. But why didn't they call us so that we can actually advise us, to advise them? Why didn't you use our reports to actually advise you in terms of what we've recommended to you? So if Parliament has this thing that there's a need to review whether the Finance and Fiscal Commission is really required, then we need to do that. Because it's an important institution to be utilized. It's the only research institution that's in the Constitution. There's no other. And that's the breadth and the width of our mandate and responsibility. So who takes us serious on our recommendations? The Treasury will say to you, we take a look at direct and indirect impacts that it has on the budget. But surely, it's not about that. That's just this one component of why we exist. That's the component about how do we carve the cake and where must the cake go. We do other recommendations, how to change the system of delivery. Because the delivery system hasn't been properly costed and priced. Because if the department comes here or the province comes here and say to you, we under-budgeted, we underfunded, I can say to you it's not true. And why can I say to you it's not true? Not that I have the facts. It's because you haven't costed and priced service delivery. We haven't costed and priced legislation and policy. During the time that we were there, so, I mean, I call it the golden era in the Treasury. The Public Finance Management Act makes it very clear that any policies that get introduced into Parliament that has an implication for sub-national government, municipality and provinces, must be costed. And if it doesn't get costed, it must be sent back to where it originates from. Now, we did that in my time. I mean, I'm sorry, I have to bring it up because there's something amiss in the institutional configuration about how legislation and policy gets introduced, creating huge burdens on the fiscal system, but also burdens on the administration. Right? And as a result, people will say to you, it's underfunded. And if you won't know whether you're underfunded if you never costed and priced something, to be able to know what the real cost is. So it's all figments of our imagination sometimes that things are undercosted. So when we table our recommendations, you'll see in the annexure of the budget review that Treasury gives us a response to it, agree and then blah, blah, blah to it. Okay? Direct or indirect, whatever the Treasury is going to say to you. I mean, I don't want to rebut stuff that's been said. I'm saying to you now, the recommendations that we're making cuts across the system, and we're sometimes specific to human settlements, agriculture, education, health, and so on and so forth. Okay? And the cherry picking of what has indirect and direct impact doesn't help. Because, and the reason why it doesn't help, and here's the thing, I am not sure whether the two houses, I'm sorry I'm doing this because it's quite important at this juncture, whether the two houses committees has actually also looked at annexure, I don't know, I think it's E or something, I might be wrong, every W1 in the budget reviews, whether those responses you're actually happy with. Because every committee needs to, researchers of the committees needs to look at those responses and see whether you also agree or disagree with the responses to that. But that's the missing thing that's currently happening. So it's hard to say whether, when you say to us you agree with something, then we'll chase it for you. But if we don't know what you agree with as different committees, we don't know how to chase honorable members. So this whole thing about the recommendations is quite an important thing. And I think it is one of the things that we need to think about. The shift of funds from infrastructure to services, I think I want to reconfirm the four things I've said in terms of the health and health sector and health budget. There are four things that always stands out in health. The one is human capital management and recruitment and appointment of requisite health staff in terms of the medical and other health services to be delivered, and staff on the administration part of it. I mean, the Minister of Health shared with me months ago that one of the things that he struggles with in the health system is the whole thing about you have people in a certain province where the head of health has got a basic education degree or qualification. Now, surely, I mean, you honorable members, and Chair, you know exactly what that means. So we need to start thinking about how do we deal with that shared function, because when things go wrong in the province and in the municipality, this is the unfortunate situation we find in a transition society, transition economy like ourselves. When things go wrong, people don't look at the provincial executive. They don't look at the municipal executive. They look at the national executive. And then they look at national parliament. That's where people want the answers from. And as a result, there are problems that I think we need to think about that. The second thing that's important is the maintenance of health infrastructure. On the one hand is the issue of buildings and other infrastructure, and the other hand is medical technology and equipment that needs that maintenance. And who's responsible for that? The third issue is health financing. The point that we're raising is if there's difficulties, you're going to get people finding creative ways to make sure they can offset the pressures on their budgets and their programs that they can actually deliver. Because you also have an Auditor General that looks at these things. But that's how people respond in an environment that's tightly constrained and that has certain rigidities. That's on the one end, the legitimate practice around it. On the other hand, you have obviously a irregular behavior that's going on, and that's what we are also highlighting to you. The third thing which deals with this hard conundrum is the supply chain, goods and services, in particular the inability, because of the concurrency nature of the function, to use properly purchasing power, especially around pharmaceutical drugs, because drugs are expensive, whether it's generic or the specific ones, as the stuff gets important, it's expensive. And the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer has tried to pull it together, I don't know how far that one is down the line, where there's a pooling effect of the resources that sits in provinces and municipalities to centrally purchase these drugs. And I think that's an important phenomenon. I mean, this is on the drugs, which is more than that, which needs to be looked at in relation to what does it mean for the intergovernmental system. And then the issue that I think sits very firmly with the chair is the issue of governance, leadership, and management. And your Section 100 matter speaks volumes about that. Now, the point is, every cycle, chairperson and honorable members, every cycle, since the days of President Mandela, in every cycle, we have had Section 100 and Section 39. And the question is, why? Why do we have that? So there's a need to further interrogate the whole question. How do we deal with governance and leadership and management issues as it relates to that? The issue that is raised, I think Honorable Dr. Blanc raised, the issue of ability of municipalities to raise funds. Because of the effects of the economy, and because of unemployment, you have a number of households that's in shock, economic shock. And what you're having, in another experience that working on, is that even the pass-through cost from ESCOM to the municipality, to the household. The reason why we don't have those pass-through costs, that is reflective cost in it, and the nature of that is a pass-through to the end user, is because in some municipalities, they are undercharging. So they buy electricity for, let's say, 40 rand kilowatts, and they sell it to their households. Probably in one instance we found ourselves with households for 7 rands. Okay? And in others they sell it for the same price. Now why are they doing that? Because in those municipalities there are extensive pockets of poverty. Deep, deep poverty where households cannot afford it. And you'll find that it's mostly in those local municipalities. It doesn't happen in the city. Because the city of Cape Town has got one of those experiences where it actually cut off the middle class to reach from enjoying the minimum basket of services. Because across the country, everybody's got access to the minimum basket of services. And what people did on the coastal line here and in the southern suburbs in Cape Town, they used the services, water and electricity, till the end of the minimum basket of service, because the rich know, the middle class know how to beat the system. And they watch when they're going to get to a water point, and they watch when they're going to get to the electricity point. And then they switch off from the main supply. And then what they do, they use green energy. Or they use their JoJo water, which is sterilized. So you don't get the income from those rich areas. So there's an issue of culture, what I call the civic duty of payment, which is under threat. Because I think using the culture of payment just gets us back into the apartheid issues why people do not pay. It's a black issue. And currently it's not a black issue, it's a civic duty to pay services that we need to install in our citizens. So the pass-through cost doesn't happen. But those municipalities on the water branch, where they are, they have a serious problem on the blockchain. Because if you don't get people to pay their taxes, the next best point to get money is to do the property tax. And that's why I said to a committee sometime in this year, be aware of that. Because you're going to have to call in municipalities, I think, my advice from the MEC, to come and account on their property taxes and the growth in property taxes. And it's got to do with the fiscal system. And it's also got to do with whether we need those municipalities. There's some places where municipalities are not under fiscal stress or economically viable issues. They're actually bankrupt. Because the cost of needing to deliver those services doesn't compare well with the revenue stream. And it's not the issue of politics, this is where the demarcation is happening and where our people are very poor. There's in one community that we heard that the only way that to keep the municipality up and running is industrial. The industries and business people paying taxes because there is. The mining areas, people are gone. There's no social responsibility coming back on. So that past and cost of household is quite a big issue. And it's going to, and I'm suggesting that you need to think about looking at that. The issue of policy certainty, I think Honorable Walter Blas has already raised it, because policy is the executive's responsibility, and we'll hear from the cabinet and the minister on that. On the payment of adjustments accordingly, I think the key point is showing, like every time when I come to the this committee meetings, so Honorable Walter Blas has got his PFMA and his constitution ready, and he shows it to all of us, and he reminds us. I think you're right. The responsibility and accountability sits with the accounting office and the executive authority, who is the minister. And it sits at the provincial level and it sits at the municipal level. And you ask, who should be called in? Who should be taking accountability? Where's the consequence? I think it's the premier that needs to be called in where it exists. I think it's the head of the premier's office, the DG there, because he or she is supposed to make sure that things are happening in terms of good governance and good management. And then there's obviously the appropriate accounting office in the MEC that needs to be called in. And I think it's going to be, I'm looking forward to the Section 100 just to see exactly how these things get done, because that's the difficulty. On the ECT grants, I think we have a problem there. Because I'm not so sure whether the ECT conditional grant is providing the right solution. Because the intent is to ensure coverage for our vulnerable children. Cradle to grave, I spoke about this in the education section. Cradle to grave, meaning from a 0 years to the end, when we die, education should be like the basic of our whole life cycle. Now, we cannot continue financing voluntarism, because that's what it is. Non-profit organizations get subsidized and develop early childhood. There's regulations that applies, there's municipal regulations, there's provincial regulations, there's national regulations, and there's a subsidy, and there are children. With all good intent of these of people that do this and provide for government, some people are not properly qualified. That's why you get sometimes situation of child abuse in some of these centers. There has to be a harder thinking. And I asked on behalf of the FFC yesterday, the Education Committee, they have to have a conversation about grade R and lower than grade R. Because the grade R response is one response. But what happens to that child that's, let's say, 4, 6 months old beyond that? And we need to take care of that because that's our future. That's the country's future. So I think we need to ask you and whoever through your own processes that we need to push a little bit downwards. Because the only people that can afford better early quality early childhood services are people in this meeting and people that's part of the middle class strata, whether it's at the lower end of the middle class or upper. The poor can't afford it. The poor doesn't even have money to buy bread. And sometimes the pooling effect that they have in their own households is not even sufficient to take them through for a whole month. So I think we need to think about that. And I think the intention was right around the early childhood grant. But it seems to me that it goes into administration and where it happens, infrastructure, and then the money is not sufficient because also that is not properly costed. In 1919, on behalf of a certain organization, I was part of a study to do an early childhood study in the country and costing and pricing it. And at that time, we did say that the state must take full responsibility, given the inequalities that we're coming from, given the poverty levels we experience, that we did a policy proposal, we don't know where it happens. Remember the yellow book and the blue books and all the books? We did a proposal on that. So early childhood, the way it looks now, is the same as what it looked in 1994. Even if people are going to tell you, no, but we're doing this, we're doing subsidization. If you just go outside the metros, you'll see how our children are not in adequate services. Not because the voluntary nature is not helping with it, but there's no form of organized way of doing it. And the subsidization is just throwing water, it's just throwing a sprinkle at it. So that these children could grow up in muck and we love it. And that they love it. On resolving the equitable share question, I think the FFC sits with the problem, and luckily we have the FFC here. Part of the problem is that the FFC historically has been part of working the treasury on it. There's been no independence in thinking. And I'm revealing to you our weakness. There's no independence in thinking. And it's got to do with the independence, whether we have the competent capabilities within the FFC to do this. Or whether there's an appetite to do it. Because we have a wag-the-dog relationship when it comes to the equitable share. And I've been at pains with the commissioners to say, we need to have our own independent view on the equitable share. Because some of us hold the view, I mean, we've studied these things and that's why we can make this comment. Is the equitable share equitable or inequitable? Because if we still sit with huge infrastructure backlogs in certain provinces. And we sit with provincial and municipal governments that's not doing the right things when it matters, you know? So on the equitable share, I think it will be great, not now, down the line, you come and ask the FFC to give its own view on the equitable share. But for now, we're working in that regime. And I think the solution of the equitable share in 1996 is no longer holding. And the problem with it, Honorable Chairperson, is that even sometimes parliamentarians and officials in departments think that the components in the equitable share is a proxy for their budgets, which in reality it isn't. In fact, it isn't a proxy. The equitable share is a block allocation. It looks at the pressures, and the numbers, demographic numbers, education, health, and access to health services, disease patterns, children between the age of 0 to 17, 18, that's school going, and that's the equitable share. So it's not a proxy for it. But so down the road, we need to look at, I'm looking forward to a point where the FFC can say to you, this is our definitive view on the equitable share. And this is what needs to be done. And the same goes for the conditional grants. We complain, conditional grants have to cut in conditional grants. And we sit in the same paradigm of, of 16 years ago. And we're not coming up with new information also. You know? Which it's got to do with the coziness and closeness of our relationship with officials in the Treasury. So we have things to do. We have things to do. Because the research we get from our officials are sometimes also have an, there's also the evidence-based question. Have you gone out to the field? In fact, you go more to the field than what our researchers do. It's a problem. So we need to think through that and so that we can bring you the right set of evidence around a number of things. And why am I raising this? Because we account to you. This committee has never called us to account on the operations of FFC, so I'm putting it to you because we've been said, you account to this one, you account to that one. We know we account to two committees. On the functions of concurrency, I don't think there's much we can say other than concurrent functions has always got a problem. It's always got a problem. Because on a concurrent function, it's difficult to work out all the time where does the function begin and end for national government, given some of these things are national priorities. And given that constitutionally, provinces and municipalities are also responsible for it. So there is a constitutional question, there is a PFMA question, and I don't think even the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act plays much into that space, other than how we should interact with each other. The main thing is the Constitution and the schedule of the Constitution and the PFMA. I think I would ask the CEO to speak on the decentralization issue, other than to say that even that debate is an efficiency debate, it's because it sits with the concurrency, as you correctly indicated. It sits with the concurrency question. And it depends sometimes we look at it. Because remember we also didn't, the issue that I always raise with in my meetings is the Constitution sets the standard of measure of functionality of a province or a municipality. It doesn't set the standard about whether you're viable or not viable. It sets the standard of what should be a viable province and what should be a viable municipality. So I'll ask the CEO to speak to that issue, the centralization, decentralization issue, and other points that I might have missed, Jefferson. But that's the point we are at, because the outcry is that we have researchers doing their work, we have the CEO, we do our stuff, and then it just become recommendations in all the committees, and that's what it is. So if this committee doesn't agree with our recommendations, then at least that we need to be told afterwards we don't agree with the recommendations. Or the other committees, I'm talking committees in general, because we talk to a number of committees. Then at least we need to know that there's not agreement on this, and we get to get the sense why there's no agreement. And then we need to go back to the drawing board. But we get left to do this year's submission. Next year we're going to talk to the whole question of municipalities, the collapse of municipalities, the financing of municipalities. And I'm being general now, and the equitable share around it, and the service delivery, and the functionalities, water, electricity, etc., so on and so forth. When we're gone, we don't know what you think of us. Other than praising us, I mean, we like the praises that we're doing now, but at the praise is not changing the system. Because our recommendation is we need to change the system in 2018. Because the system is not working in all parts of it. Because some part of the system is broken. And it's not for the Treasury to fix. Because the Treasury is on this trajectory of trying to manage the fiscus of the country. It goes broader than that. What's happening in provinces? We have Section 100. What's happening in municipality? Section 139. That speaks to the functionality of those subnational governments, Chairperson. Can I hand over to Kay? Because I think I'm...
You will have to take note of the study that was done by the University of Wits regarding the success
success of interventions. There's a study. Secondly, a study done by the University of the Free State on the matter of the equitable share. That was in 2016. Yes. So there's also information available. Dr. Brown.
So thank you very much. I think perhaps to start off with a broader thought, perhaps on the point where the chairperson stopped with saying, you know, we look at interventions, we look at various dimensions, but and I think what also came up from some of the comments of members is we look then at different conditions in a conditional grant. Is there uncertainty in some instances, etc. But I think one of the key things is accountability, and what does accountability mean? And I think from the work that we see in the FFC in terms of this submission, and also especially as articulated by the chairperson now, I think there is a necessity to not think that it's 16 years ago, not to think that it's 20 years ago, and take it and play it as it lies in terms of the path that we're on. But there is a serious need to rethink some of the fundamental and basic issues and to go back to the Constitution. What does accountability really mean? How do we want to make people account? Is it in terms of the monitoring and evaluation system? Currently, is that system working? In terms of the fiscal framework, we talk about different areas of the budget. We say water, we think you should do this, and so on and so on. But to what extent do we go back to the drawing board and say, look, maybe we even need to look at the macro organization of the state. Maybe we mustn't work within our current configurations. Maybe they're not working for us. We have, and what is quite pointed and has certainly come up today as well, is the issues around concurrence and the issues around coordination. To what extent are those perhaps structural and in terms of the way in which we are currently structured, and to what extent are those beyond just sticking to the word of the law, but talk more broadly to accountability more broadly and to the spirit and intent of how we should be cooperating with each other, whether that be across spheres of government, whether that be parliament to government, to institutions, other institutions, and so on. So I think there are some points, and perhaps our first chapter also spoke a little bit to that. It was framed very much within the economy and perhaps the fiscal framework. But even more broadly, I think we do need to think as a country as to how we structure ourselves. In terms of the fiscal framework, we talk about taxes, but we talk about it in terms of our current system and set of taxes. The chairperson's already alluded to the fact, for example, that in terms of local governments, there's a huge structural change and a behavioural change of citizens in terms of their tax behaviour and pressures. And do we then look at property taxes, which is correct, but then do we even look more broadly? Should we be looking at other ways of getting that civic responsibility that is required in order to get the national development that we need? So I think, I know that the chairperson also was now clearly confessing and giving me a few pointers and some information around what my duties are and what the FFC's duties are. But I think when we think around those new ways and new approaches, and even us in the FFC, we also need to think about how that is located within, the broad environment. And I think what we were saying, for example, in Chapter 1, and it comes back to the policy uncertainty that was raised here, is what is the growth story? And it's correct, I think, of the members to ask of us, what is your take on it? But obviously, that is something for us as South Africa to solve. But clearly, when you've got that sort of huge uncertainty around exactly what is the growth story, then even when you come to the equitable share and you try to figure out what you want to do with that, it's very important what is the broad framework, and then, for example, in terms of the equitable share. I think also the chairperson did also allude to some areas where there are misconceptions and where perhaps we start dealing with things technically and correctly so, but then in other areas the interpretation must be different. So for example, the equitable share is a technical exercise. We would try our best to use the kind of proxies and information in order to make it as equitable as it should be. However, in terms of our recommendations, and I think the Treasury would do it in terms of what it would table, yet when that equitable share comes to a particular province, then it doesn't come as predetermined in terms of certain factors. It comes as a block grant. And then it is for the accountability there and for those that are accountable to actually apply that in the best possible way in terms of its priorities for the particular province, or in terms of the local equitable share for the municipal development. So I think sometimes also we are responding technically to things and find a comfort zone in saying, oh, but should the phasing in be quicker, for example, in an equitable share, should the phasing in, because we've got new stats on this or whatever, be quicker, but it's an important debate, but in some senses it's perhaps a false debate. We do need to focus on what is the growth story and what are we trying to achieve and what are the higher order things that we're trying to be accountable for. So I think that's almost like a backdrop to the submission in a way that I think the chairperson was also trying to allude to some elements. In terms of, to be a little bit more specific now, in terms of the re-centralization, I think we are not saying we're against re-centralization explicitly. What we're saying is that we shouldn't have an upfront or a priori position on re-centralization. We can't just say re-centralization works, or if something's not working in a province, if something's not working in a municipality, then take the function to the center. What we're arguing for is that it is analyzed on a case-by-case basis, that we would ask that of government that there's a proper case study put forward in terms of why you would want to re-centralize something, and what specifically is the problem that's being resolved, and how particularly it would be that if you moved it to national, that would be better. Because we all know, and as Poppy had also explained, there are financial implications, but also as soon as you move something, there are setup costs. So automatically when you move something, by definition, there will be some inefficiency as a program has to set up. So you do need to be very clear on the long-run benefits of such a move outweighing the costs in the long run. So we also then say we don't want a blanket approach. So we don't say, okay, well, now we're moving, for example, if I make the example, say all TVET colleges. Perhaps, yes, there needed to be a broad overall case study, but perhaps there needed to be different categorizations and perhaps some re-centralization, perhaps some not, perhaps a more disaggregated and specific way of dealing with efficiency. And I think that came back to the point that I was trying to make when I was concluding, that I think the key is efficiency and not necessarily always about treating a particular category all in the same way. And I think perhaps that's where some of the work of the FFC, I think, should go in future, is to look at perhaps there's a different interpretation of accountability, and perhaps there's a different interpretation of what equity means and how we would define equity. And yes, of course, it's important to treat everyone fairly, but that doesn't necessarily mean it means that you always treat everyone exactly the same. And I think also then, in terms of government's business and efficiency, that is probably something that we need to focus on. If you want proper value for money, if you want efficiency, it's very important to be very specific about what the problems are in a particular domain, and also what the solutions can be, and not just this one size fits all. I'm going to hand over to Mr. Tseng. There was a specific question on slide 7, I think, and then also if Ms. Ntaka wants to come in.
Mr. Singh, are you ready?
Yes. Okay. So, So slide 7 is just it's just a repeat of the socioeconomic profile overview of some of the basic social basis socioeconomic indicators of provinces, and then the color coding is obviously relative between provinces, the sort of from low to high, red to green, but I think the I think is more interesting though is the next slide, which was on the re-centralization there. Really, and earlier we said all our sort of cautionary notes around re-centralization, but the exercise there, the numerical exercise that I've done there, really show just how the end, the real money outcome and of the shifts, the difference between the budgets for those financial years. I should have probably said a little bit more, but if you, and then I think the word I want to use is the disproportionate cut, that how this re-centralization is being affected upon the overall fiscal framework of the NDF. Yes. Yeah, that it is a disproportionate cut on the subnational level. That the re-centralization is implemented.
Are you done? Mr. Kenyon, you listened very carefully. I watched you. Yes. I'm going to give you the opportunity to make an input, although Treasury do a formal response to the recommendations which we'll be dealing with during the tabling of the national budget. But you're welcome to make an input. One question. The equitable share. Allocations to a province, to a municipality. That reporting on that money. Give some detail about that. Are you following the money? Specific money to go to the indigent people, poor people. Yes. Because that's part of our oversight. Your document today, your presentation, is actually a monitoring tool for members of parliament. Yes. And this can be developed into a monitoring document for members coming after the 29 election to be inducted with. Land up in parliament, then what must I do? Yes. Thank you, Mr. Kenyon.
Thank you, Chair. And I appreciate the opportunity to come in because this is, as you noted, not really the Treasury's moment to respond. So we respond formally to the committee's recommendations. In fact, it's not us that responds, it's the whole of government response. The responses that we give in Annexure W1 to the Division of Revenue Bill are endorsed by Cabinet, so they're the responses of the whole of government in that sense. And I'm going to ask my colleague, Mr. Pakis, to speak in a moment about the process of preparing those responses. But just to say, to give a few brief comments on some of the other issues that have been raised. I mean, firstly, I think from the Treasury side, we respect the independence of the FFC. I think it's a very important constitutional entity. We also value greatly the close working relationship that we do have, and I think it's important just, I don't want the committee to come away with the impression that the FFC are somehow in our pocket. I think we respect them as a research organisation, and we do have a close working relationship, which I think is valuable in that it means that the FFC has the opportunity to understand in greater detail how the decisions that we come to are arrived at. So, for example, we also learn from the FFC. So, for example, earlier this year we had a Lokotla for all of the provincial treasuries and the national treasury. One of the agenda items there was the ongoing review of the provincial equitable share formula. And the FFC gave a very lengthy and detailed and insightful presentation that really enriched the discussion. And I think that kind of working relationship we get a lot of value out of, and we'd like to continue that while also respecting that the FFC has every right to turn around later and tell us that they think that, you know, they've given us the advice, we haven't taken it, or even if we take their advice, they still have the right to come back and tell us that we've done the wrong thing. On the equitable share, I think, you know, the thing we always try to point out with the equitable shares, both the provincial and the local government ones, is that it's about slicing a cake, right? So there's the question about the absolute size of the equitable shares to provinces and to local governments. And then the equitable share formulas are the formulas that divide the provincial equitable share into 9 different parts for each of the 9 provinces. And I think it's worth repeating that Gauteng and the Northern Cape can never both be happy with that. In fact, they're both always going to be unhappy with that, right? Because whichever province is gaining, the other 8 must, you know, be giving up some slice, and the one that's gaining never thinks it's gaining enough. You know, so I think I think if we're setting a target that you're going to one day get all 9 provinces into this room and they're all going to nod and say, yeah, we're happy with the equitable share, I think we've set an impossible target there. But with that in mind, with that said, I mean, we work to refine, to review, to monitor how that equitable share is changing, and I think the particular challenge that we have at the moment, particularly with the provincial equitable share formula, is that there isn't a lot of real growth in the overall envelope for the provincial equitable share. And that makes the differences much more pronounced. So in what Professor Plaikies refers to as the golden period of the Treasury, which was a period when we had revenue surpluses, when we had even a fiscal surplus in the one year, we were able to smooth over differences between provinces by adding money to the formula. So whenever there was a change, you just added more money and no one ever lost, you know, and that's a very, I can see why you call it the golden times. These are much tougher times now that we're facing. It means that when adjustments have to be made, there is pain that has to be taken in that. When we have to make reductions to the growth in the provincial equitable share, etc., all of the provinces feel pain. It puts a lot more pressure on the system. And so I think that's why you see a lot more complaints about the mechanisms. It's why we keep working to review and refine them. But I think your question, Chair, is the right one to ask, is how is the equitable share funding actually spent when it reaches provinces and municipalities? And I think that goes a lot to the questions that Dr. Brown was highlighting around accountability, and to what Professor Plaikies was saying about looking more broadly at the system in which we're in. Because I think always remember that in terms of the Constitution, the equitable share allocations are unconditional transfers. So it is, and the Constitution sets up spheres of government with their own accountable structures, right? So provincial governments are accountable to their electorate, municipal governments are accountable to their electorate, and the equitable share is a substantive contribution towards them being able to perform their function as those elected governments choose to prioritize them. That's why we say, that's why the FFC has reminded you today, the equitable share formulas are not pro forma budgets. Although we allocate money based on education, health needs, etc. for provinces, on water, electricity, free basic services for local governments, we're not in any way requiring that those monies be used in those exact proportions in provinces and municipalities. They're there to contribute to the funding of the overall budget, and that overall budget is what needs to make sense, particularly in the case of local government, where so much of the revenues of local government is raised from own revenues, particularly in more urban and wealthier municipalities. Most of the funds come from own revenues. Even in rural and poorer municipalities, there's some own revenue contribution. And so accountability rests at the level of the whole municipal budget when it comes to equitable share funds. So on conditional grants, we monitor those line by line. We monitor every cent that is spent against that purpose. On the equitable share funds, we monitor it as part of the overall budget. And I think we've highlighted to the committee in our submissions at the beginning of the year that we have some real concerns, especially on the municipal side, about those budgets. That municipalities are tabling unfunded budgets, which means that they're starting the year with a plan to fail. They don't have realistic revenues that will cover their expenditures, which means that they're almost certain to get into trouble during the course of the year. We have also highlighted, and I think others have highlighted, that the composition of municipal spend, particularly in more rural municipalities, there's a very high proportion that is spent on salaries there's a very high proportion that is spent within the municipal headquarters rather than on service delivery outside of the municipal headquarters. My colleague sitting next to me, Mr. Pakis, not yet Dr. Pakis, did some research which we included in this year's budget review, looking back at when we introduced the new local government equitable share formula in 2013, there were some rural municipalities that really gained tremendously from the introduction of that new formula. And so he looked back at what had the impact been, how had those additional funds been used in those rural municipalities. And the finding was quite striking, that the majority of that money appears to have gone into wage costs. So we had expected that it would go into service delivery. We'd expected that you would see more spending in water and sanitation, electricity, etc. Actually, what happens is that you see wage costs increase. The data on the number of personnel is a little bit spotty, right? But there doesn't appear to be an increase in employment in those municipalities as a cohort. So it seems like salaries have increased quite substantively. So that's the kind of thing where I think as we said at the beginning, those unconditional funds and the accountability for making those choices rests with those elected councils. And I think that's really where we think there's a lot of scope to dig deeper. And I think with respect to the FFC recommendations that are here today, I mean, I think that's where the FFC has stopped. They haven't gone into those questions. So you'll see the FFC making recommendations that we should give rural municipalities more flexibility in how they use conditional grants in a constrained fiscal environment. But I don't think you see the FFC going into what are the choices that municipalities actually make with the flexibility that they have, and what those implications would be. And I think that would be an interesting area, and I don't know whether the FFC is looking towards that next year. But as I said, we will respond in full to the recommendations that are directly and indirectly related to the Division of Revenue in the budget. But I just want, Professor like you said, that we cherry-pick those recommendations, and I don't think that's quite accurate, so if my colleague can just take you through that process.
Mr. Barkis, that research that you've done, have you completed it? Can we get a copy of that?
We can make it up.
I'm very interested in your analysis. I think the rest of the members as well. Because it's a concern for me. If money is not going where it's supposed to go, then Parliament must intervene. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Welcome the opportunity. Good day, honourable members. I think the professor has spoken about the classification of the FFC recommendations, which the Treasurer and FFC sit and try to work out which of the recommendations would be responded to through the explanatory memo of the Division of Revenue. And I think this year, again, we've gone through the same process of ensuring that, you know, all the recommendations that are directly and indirectly related as to give effect to Section 214 of the Constitution and the Intergovernmental Relations Act, which requires the Minister of Finance to table those, you know, as an explanatory memorandum when he tables his budget. And we have gone through an extensive process of then finding each other in terms of which of those. But I think the big question remains on the unrelated recommendations. Those recommendations that perhaps, you know, as the House has noted, you know, cut across, you know, the various sectors as well as the departments or maybe, you know, the spheres of government. You know, those recommendations are then forwarded to the relevant institutions or departments through two processes. The first process was when we then did the first consultation. So after having consulted with the FFC, we then sent out all the recommendations to all the sector departments, to all the provinces, for them to then take note. But specifically, those recommendations that related to specific sectors, those sectors were then asked to then respond to the FFC directly. So that is through the first process of consultation. Those letters were sent by the DDG within the National Treasurer of Intergovernmental Relations. Now, in the second consultation process, which we are beginning with, the Minister of Finance will still send letters to the specific ministers on a political level, highlighting those recommendations that relate to their departments and ask them to respond directly to the FFC. And the FFC would be copied in that correspondence. Now, what the professor has said is that there's normally no response that is then attained through that process. I think then that's where perhaps, you know, the committee would come in and then hold those specific departments accountable. So we are in the process of beginning with our second consultation, where we have received from all the provinces and some of the sector departments their responses or their take on what the FFC recommendations are saying, and we have consolidated preliminary findings from those to then circulate again in the second consultation to ensure that all the recommendations find traction within government as a whole. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for the input from the Treasury. All the members, that brings us to the end of this session. Thank you for Professor and your team to ignite our thinking and also to tell us actually to do things differently. Yes. All the members, this presentation actually gives us a direction putting questions to the economic cluster in the NCOP that is now coming up. So there's another analysis, and that can guide us in terms of that. Our next engagement of the Select Committee Appropriations will be jointly on the 23rd of October with all the other committees, finance appropriations on the pre-MTPBS briefing. Then the lock-up session the morning of the 24th, 10 o'clock of October. And then the 25th at 12:30 until 3 o'clock, the briefing by the Honourable Minister of Finance, just newly appointed. He's made an MTPBS presentation and briefing to the four committees, and then dealing with the whole processing of the MTPBS in terms of the fiscal framework, revised fiscal framework, proposed fiscal framework, Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, and the Appropriations Amendment Bill that will take us up to the end of November, beginning of December. With those words, thank you for all your inputs. Thank you for the staff for preparing and arranging this meeting. This meeting is closed, and the chair, thank you.